Kia ora, morning everyone, how are you? Excellent. Hey, does anyone not know who I am? I've not been here for the last two or three weeks. So basically I'm Glenn, I go to this church. It's about my name, my claim to fame. So I've been doing a three-week series titled Entering Easter. We've got quite a bit to go through this morning. So there's a couple of things that I expect to go wrong. One is there'll be some sort of technological malfunction, and which is a given. And two, we could be tight on time. So I just want to kind of warn you before I get into the message this morning. Though I think Dawn, you had a word to share with us. So I just invite you to come up and share that this morning. There you go.
Thank you. Just at the end of the service, I'd love to pray for somebody who's having some issues with a gallbladder, you know, just gallbladder symptoms, and a tooth, upper right tooth. And if I've got the position wrong, then I'm happy to pray for any tooth, and if it's not a tooth, I'd love to pray for that. Thank you.
Thanks, Dawn. Okay, so... as I said, this is the third week in my series, and I haven't forgot about the gamification. Remember the gamification? So if you came to all 3 weeks, you get an Easter egg. Who remembers that? You all remember that because you all remind me of it furiously. My youngest son, Kyson, he'll be in the foyer after the service. So if you've been to all three services, you will be getting a what is it? What's the flavor? Honeycomb or something? Chocolate Easter egg. It happens to be the smallest Easter egg that's ever been created. But it is an Easter egg nonetheless, right? So I've done this series, Entering Easter, because it's easy for Easter to get lost into the busyness of life. When I started the series, I thought that, you know, you'd start, where all good sermons should start. I Googled Easter. And believe it or not, this is what came up for Easter when I Googled it. I don't know if any of you are surprised, but I mean, everyone knows what Google is, right? Yep. So I, you know, the search engine, I entered Easter, and this is what came up. Now, can you see Jesus right up there at the top there, in the top right-hand corner on a cross? Isn't that amazing that... That's what, you know, Google's got all pretty much all the information in the world sitting in some big store warehouse or something somewhere. And it's finding everything that people searching for and the frequency and all that sort of stuff. And this is what the world sees as Easter. Man, quite surprising, eh? No? All right. Although it's probably not that surprising. Everyone's so keen on those Easter eggs after the service, right? So there we go. So like I said, I've got a few things to get through. Today, week one, we covered the great price. Week two, we covered the great reward. And this in week three, I'm talking about the great story. And I would have liked to have ended with this with a big kind of crescendo, but this is more of a bringing the pieces together around Easter. So to kick things off, I'm going to get my son to come up and do the reading for us. So, Nate, would you like to make your way up, buddy?
Today I'm reading Matthew 28:1-15. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were as white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the woman, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus, who is crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay, and go quickly and tell his disciples. He has risen from the dead, and he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you." So the woman hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, 'His disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble.'" So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day.
Good work, buddy. Well done. He didn't realize it was that hard, but that's good. Now we've got a video to play. So we got that video ready?
When the Messiah comes, Rome will be nothing!
Until then, the Nazarene city would rise again after 3 days. You will lose peace and order if it's true. Will the people believe it? The weak will.
There will be no other gods.
Kill him.
The tomb is sealed, guarded with your life.
Tribune, Pilate summons you.
The body has vanished.
His tomb is empty.
Where has he gone?
You tell me.
Already there, proclaiming him risen from death.
The Emperor cannot arrive to unrest. We must find a body.
No! No!
Combed the city for bodies dead in the last week.
Take them up.
Everyone.
His disciples. Where are they hiding his corpse?
It was not his followers.
Another body, sir, just revealed.
No.
Who told you the Nazarene was alive?
Mary Magdalene.
You're looking for something you'll never find.
Open your heart and see.
No more lies. What happened to the body?
The ropes, they just exploded.
You should have returned by now.
I have seen two things which cannot reconcile. A man dead without question. And that same man alive again.
Being wrong, wagering eternity on it.
Great, thank you. Jeez, is it just me or does that look kind of exciting? This is the latest Hollywood attempt to retell the story of Jesus. Of course, it's not the first time. I had a quick look online and there's been at least 50 movies that they've made trying to convey the story of Jesus. And of course there's been plays and stage shows and radio series and countless books that try to retell the story. And obviously we don't gauge the merit of a story by its cinematic release. But there is obviously something that's really imminent about this story of Jesus, the story of Jesus. The gospel, that's what it is. It went viral long before we even knew what that meant. The story spanned the breadth of the globe and it went into the depths of language and culture and dialect. Many of you will probably remember the 1965 release of the Jesus story. It was Academy Award nominated and it was titled The Greatest Story Ever Told. And maybe that is true. The obvious question for me is, what makes this story so great? What makes the Jesus story, what makes the gospel so great? And, as a follower of Jesus, as a believer of the story. It's my quick, you know, fire response is to say, well, it's powerful because it's true, and it's spread so widely and so popular because of the Holy Spirit and its work. But this morning, I kind of want to car park those assumptions, and I just want to sort of almost take an agnostic perspective, point of view, and offer this morning three ideas, just ideas on why I think this story has really taken off. Why the gospel has gone so viral. And my first thought is this. The story is simple. Great stories hold true. Those of you who are here, I'm sure you'll remember I talked about Everest, this great mountain. You obviously know that it's the tallest mountain in the world, and it was discovered as such in 1852. Which made me think, well, 1852 is a long time ago, right? It's a long time ago? 1852 is a long time ago. I was Googling 1852, and they had a picture of like this big sort of balloon blimp with strings attached and this guy sitting in this chair underneath it, and this was air travel in 1852. 1852, there was very, very little technology. How do you measure the height of a mountain like Everest? And how do you determine it's taller than any other mountains? So what they'd do is they'd basically take photographs of the mountain range from at least 100 miles away. And the three different photographs they'd use to apply rules to determine which was the highest peak. And obviously in this range, Everest was one of those peaks. And they'd systematically apply these calculations and take into account such things as the curvature of the Earth, atmospheric refractions, and plumb line deflection. You know, all the things we'd take into consideration measuring a mountain, as we well know. The normal stuff. And all of these peaks had a number, and Everest was number 15. And no one suspected peak 15 to be the tallest, because the way that you looked at it, the other mountains before it looked bigger than it. But what they did is they went through and they systematically applied all these calculations religiously. And sure enough, peak 15 comes out as the tallest mountain. And the height that they give it, 29,002 feet. So how many years has it been since 1852, Justin? About 160-odd? 160 years later, 2016. We've got satellite technology. We've got GPS. We've got lasers. We've got it all. We've got all this technology, and we can re-measure the mountain. And you know what's happened? We've added 26 feet. 26 feet since in 160 years of technology. Isn't that amazing? What's my point? Fair enough. I reckon we can be guilty of doing the same with God's story. I reckon we can be guilty of doing the same with the gospel. Every Sunday we get together and we talk about it. We sing about it. We have seven-day conferences about it. We build great buildings and ornaments about it. We install heat pumps and sound systems. We decipher codes about it. We devise new revised programs about it. We decorate it. We run events about it. We ask delving deep questions about it. We work faster. We pray harder. We judge ourselves about it. We use it to judge others. And we even give out free Easter eggs. We all do all of this stuff over 2,000 years, but here's the thing. None of these things are bad things. They're actually probably good things. But none of these things add a single centimeter or take a single millimeter away from the gospel, the story of Jesus Christ. Because it's not our story. The gospel is not our story. It's God's story. It's that simple. It's not about us and what we do. It's about God and what he has done. It's not about our understanding of him. It's not about our theology, our understanding of him. It's about his understanding of us. Theologian N.T. Wright said, "Arguments about God are like pointing a flashlight towards the sky to see if the sun is shining." In our cell group, we were discussing what is the true gospel, what is this true Jesus story the other night. And the question came up, If an alien came to Earth, what would we tell them? How would we explain it? And for me, the story of the two sisters, Mary and Martha, and their brother Lazarus came to mind. See, these three siblings, they knew Jesus well. They had hosted him in their house. So when Lazarus falls gravely ill, Mary and Martha, they send a message to Jesus. Jesus, Lazarus is really sick. You need to come. You need to heal him. You need to fix him or he's going to die. Well, the thing is, Jesus has got a lot on, right? So he ends up taking his time getting back. And by the time he gets back to them, Jesus has been dead for 4 days. Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Wow, people are listening. This is great. This is good. Because there's others sleeping, and you guys are listening. So it balances each other out, right? This is good. Thank you. Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. And it's a great scene that captures our great problem. Am I right? It's a great scene. And that problem is death. It's a pretty big problem that all of us have to face. There was nothing that Mary or Martha or Lazarus or their doctor or their priest or their mother or their father or their bank manager, there was nothing that anyone could do about their problem. There was nothing that could be done. The only hope they had was that Jesus could do something. And this is the one central truth that everything is pinned on in the gospel. That Jesus can do something about the problem of death. We as a whānau have just booked a family holiday. And this is what happened. We went to the Travel Expo and we saw a really good deal. And we thought, wow, okay, let's book that deal. So you kind of book the deal, and then the guy goes, oh, well, let's come back during the week and we'll confirm some of the details. And you go back to the week and you're like, oh, Google the accommodation. You're like, oh, it would be a bit nicer to have accommodation in a bit of a nicer place. Maybe just a slight upgrade, and oh, we've got to get the theme park sorted and all of those types of things. And you're sort of just adding a little bit here and tweaking a little bit there. And what you end up is this great holiday at a great price. And it's the same for life. We can live our lives however we want. We can add this, we can do that, we can do whatever we want with our lives. But the thing is, at the end of our lives, the bill is going to come. Do we get that? Our lives are ours. We can do whatever we want with us. But every single person, we're going to choose our life, we're going to make our decisions, we're going to make our choices, we're going to live out our lives, and at the end of our life, the bill's going to come. And what's the cost of life? What is it? Death. That's it. Here you go. Great life. You did well. Here's the bill. You're going to die. It's really simple. Am I right? That's what it is. The price of life is death. But imagine if, and I did imagine, someone came into that, where did we book it? Flight Center. Came to Flight Center and they said, Glenn, I'm going to pay for your holiday. I'm going to pay the price for your great holiday. And this is what Jesus does with his amazingly simple story. Is he comes in and he says, I'll pay the price. You live your life, you make your choices, and I'll pay the price for you. So you don't have to die. Even though that you die, you may live. It's the same equation for us today. This is what Jesus said to Mary and Martha. If you believe in me, you will live even when you die. And they believed, and Lazarus lived. It's the same for us today. Nothing has been added, and nothing has been taken away from this very simple truth. One day, all of us will face death. As Jake Bailey said in the speech last week, none of us get out of this life alive. We're all going to face death. And if we want to live again, we simply have to believe. It's that simple. So the first reason I think it's a great story is because it's so simple. The second reason is this. It's believable. The stories, it's believable. Great stories need to make sense. I've got a friend who's just started watching the series Lost on Netflix. Has anyone seen, or did anyone follow the series Lost? Put your hand right, don't be ashamed, this is confession time. Confess your sins before your brothers and sisters. I don't know what to do. I just want to reach out to her and say, do not waste your life. Because Lost was interesting enough. There were polar bears. There were flashbacks. There were flash forwards. There was even flash sidewayses. But the problem is you have no idea what's going on. It doesn't make sense. But you watch the next week because you're just hoping that there is going to be some kind of enlightenment in the next week that's going to make the previous week makes more sense. But the madness just continues, and it continues like this for 5 years. No, seriously, 5 years, you're sitting down watching the final of this episode, and you don't want to be there. It's like a bad relationship. And you just don't want to be there, but you're just pot committed, and you're watching this final, and you're thinking, this must be the best 60 minutes the world has ever seen to bring all of this madness into to make sense. But it doesn't deliver. Nothing makes sense. A great story needs to make sense, even if it's crazy. Even if it's extraordinary, a great story needs to make sense. Its characters, their behaviors, the motives, they need to be believable, even if it's fanciful. A great story makes sense. It's believable. And this is what the gospel does so well. This is what the story of Jesus does so well. Even though he walks on water, that's crazy. Even though he heals the sick, even though he restores sight to the blind, and he raises Lazarus from the dead, even though Jesus, God himself, goes into the grave for 3 days before he rises from the dead, it does actually make sense when you consider he's God in the flesh. When you think if he is who he says he was, it kind of makes sense that God would and could do these things. Despite it being extraordinary, the story of Jesus makes perfect sense. That God would come and rescue his creation. After all, we are his. Would we not do that for our children? It's perfectly believable. So the question then is not, could it be true? But do you believe that it's true? The question is not, is it true? But the question you have to answer is, do you believe the gospel is true? This is the same question that Mary and Martha had to answer. Do you believe? It's the same question faced by the Roman official in our video this morning, isn't it? In that final scene of our video clip, we see him asked, what frightens you? And he answers, being wrong and wagering eternity on it. So if the crux is your choice to believe, the obvious question to me is, can we choose to believe? We discussed this in our cell group as well. What do you think? Do you think we can choose to believe? Put your hand up if you think we can choose to believe. Put your hand up if you think we can't choose to believe. And abstentions? Landslide with the abstentions? We're going to be like the flag. So like I said, we discussed this in our cell group. It's probably a bit like that. In our cell group, our small group. And the consensus of the group was no. You can't make yourself believe. And you think of it a bit like this. Star signs. Star signs, I just can't make myself believe in them. I just don't believe. It just doesn't make sense. I just can't. I can't make myself believe in star signs, can I? But I've been thinking about this question a little more since then, and I'm not convinced we got it right. And here's what I think. I think it's more like a jury. We see the evidence, and although we're not we may not know for certain, we do actually have to take that evidence and we have to make a choice. We have to make a decision with what we've seen and heard. We can't just sit there and say, "Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not gonna make a choice on this. I don't know." You may have doubts over the person's guilt or innocence, but you still have to make a choice, and sometimes you'll just have to live with that doubt. You've got to make a choice. And there may be some of us in this room, there will be some people in this room this morning that have never made that choice. We just sit and we wait. We're hoping for the smoking gun that proves beyond any shadow of a doubt that Jesus is who he said he was. You're kind of hoping that you don't actually have to believe, because that's what belief is. You've got to believe in it. Just like Mary and Martha, and just like a Roman official, each of us must answer the question asked by Jesus. Do you believe? Do you believe? The story is simple. The story is believable. And my third thought is, the story is sensational. Jesus' story, the gospel, is so great because it's so sensational. Great stories are not boring, are they? I really love that trailer this morning. It's for the movie Risen. That's going to be out at the moment, out now. It's so exciting because it so brilliantly captures just how sensational the events were that followed after Jesus' death and resurrection. It captures what things must have been like. Now think of this. The officials and indeed the entire social and political structures of the time were being questioned. You didn't question the Roman authority. You didn't. And all of a sudden, these questions and this alternative way of thinking and living and being was coming out of these unwieldy bunch of disciples of Jesus. These radicals. And if the claims of Jesus were actually true, then the entire world and the powers and political structures would be turned on its head. And you can imagine, this isn't good for the ruling authorities of the time. And here's the thing. Jesus is teaching, Jesus is spreading the stuff, people are interested, people are picking up on it. But it's kind of getting a bit kind of make or break here when they're nailing the guy to a cross for what he's saying. They're calling him a liar, they're saying he's misleading people, they're saying he's crazy, and they're nailing him to a cross. And it all comes down to this. Jesus has told people he's the Son of God. He said they're going to come and do this. They said they're going to nail him to the cross. He said they're going to put him in a grave. And then what did he say would happen? He'd rise again. This is pretty important, this whole rising again thing. When Jesus went into the grave, every eye through all of eternity was on that tomb to see what would happen. And this is why the Romans are so desperate to find his body. Do you get how sensational this is? Author, pastor, and theologian Tim Keller suggests, if Jesus rose from the dead, then you have to accept all that he said. If he didn't rise from the dead, then why worry about any of what he said? The issue on which everything hangs is not whether or not you like his teaching. You wear his t-shirt, you go to his church, you sing his songs. This is not what it hangs on. It hangs on whether or not he rose from the dead. So, understandably, the empire applies its mighty force and resource to shut this whole thing down, and they begin this frantic search to find Jesus. The story's sensational. It's sensational. And it makes sense. Jesus lived a sensational life. He died a sensational death. And sensationally, he rose again. So to me, it makes sense that anyone who claims to follow Jesus would also live a sensational life, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that make sense? And we see it again and again in the gospel and in the Bible about the followers of Jesus. Sensational lives. And we see it in the lives of the people that have gone before us, and we see it in the lives of the people beside us, don't we? Christian author Shane Claiborne said, "The more I get to know Jesus, the more trouble he seems to get me into." So here's my final challenge for us this morning. Do we live sensational lives? If the rulers of our time were trying to shut down this whole Christian thing because it was radical, if the rulers of our time were trying to shut the whole thing down, would they come to your house? What would lead them to your house? And if they kicked in your door, what sensational evidence would they find that Jesus is still alive and well? What would take them to your house, and what evidence would they find to show that Jesus is indeed alive and well? Would our white picket fence give it away? A fresh coat of paint? Would the fact that we've managed to pay our mortgage down to avoid interest, would that be the dead giveaway that Jesus is still alive and well? Or would our conservative family values, would that prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus was alive? Or would it be our veggie garden and our tidy lawns, or the new dress, or the straight teeth, or the 2.5 kids and the dog? And would these be the giveaway to this sensational Jesus still being alive? Is this the radical faith we've been called to? Is this the evidence that we're all followers of a revolutionary Savior? What evidence would they have against us that we followed this Jesus and he was alive and well? When I pastored here at the church as a youth associate pastor, and when I first started, I was really nervous and not very good, and Lois took me under my wing a bit, and because she's always got a piece of advice or two, eh, Lois? And she handed me these tapes, these Navigator tapes. When I say tapes, I'm talking tape cassettes. It was Navigator tapes, right? And who was the speaker? Like a Wallace or a... I was hoping you'd help me out here, Lois. I didn't even write the notes because I thought I'd just rely on Lois. Mega memory. All right, she hands me these tapes, and they're Navigator tapes. And Navigator tapes is really basic Christian teaching. Anyone else follow Navigators? Can anyone help me answer who this person was? Definitely wasn't him? Well, maybe. Anyway, so he's got these tapes. And there's one story on there that just absolutely stuck in my head. And it was the story of the tapes at the... He was talking about the tapes made with the... Geez, I'm losing it here. What was the great political... Watergate. The tapes made about Watergate. So they recorded all the conversations. Watergate was this great political crime that happened in the States. And they find the tapes of all the conversations that they had that time to use against the political powers. But what they had done... So they get the tapes, and they've got all the tapes of all the conversations. But what they had done is they had recorded out every bad thing. So you're going along here, it's just getting interesting and juicy, we're just going to get him here, and boom, it's silence. It's just, it's taken out of the tape. And for me, this is what happens in our faith. It's like, you know, we get to live this life, we get to make our choices, we get to do our stuff. It's like an athlete or a rugby player plays their career, and at the end of the career, they always have this sort of highlights package, don't they? Of the player's career, they have this highlights package. It's never the knock-ons. It's not the bad things, it's not the mistakes they made, it's none of that. It's all taken out, it's all forgotten. Forget about that. All it is the highlights, the sensational hits, the sensational runs, the sensational tries. That's all that's left. And for me, this is the Jesus story. I get to live my life. I get to believe in Him. He takes all of the bad stuff that I do and He removes it from the tape. It's no longer there. And what am I left with? I'm left with my highlights reel. And it just makes me think, is the Christian faith as simple as this? Should we just be living out our lives, our days, our finite days here on earth, doing as many sensational things for the gospel as we possibly can to get the best tape as we go into that glorious reception? So we've got a couple more things to finish the service. We're going to move now to the communion table, and we've also got a dance that will go straight after that. So I think the elders are going to serve communion, but I do just have a thought for us as we do that. So Jesus gathers his disciples together just before he's crucified. He gathers his people together and he says, "All right, I'm going to take and break this bread. As a symbol of my body broken for you. And I'm going to pour this wine as a symbol of my blood spilt for you." The other night, I went to a black tie event, and the speaker there was Richie McCaw. And if anyone had a good highlights reel, there's a guy that would have a good reel, right? And they asked him, and he answered a lot of questions through the night. Questions like around training, around team culture, around game plans, around many different things, with what he's done in his life and what he's achieved. And then the question came, "Richie, out of all the things you've talked about, of all the situations you've been in, and of all the challenges you've had to face, what would your most important piece of advice would be?" And Richie just said, "Well, I don't know. Well, actually, what you've got to do is you've got to go all in. You've got to go all in." And as we come to this table, think about these things. I mean, think about what these disciples could have. Wouldn't they much rather Jesus to have said, "Look, take this 10 to 11:30 a.m. on a Sunday morning, and remember me with it"? Wouldn't they have preferred him to say, "Look, you know, take these songs and sing them and remember me"? Or read this book. Read it religiously and remember me. But Jesus says, "My very body, my very blood, my everything." This is the faith. This is how you remember me. It's everything. You've got to go all in. So as we take these elements this morning, let's think about those things. Let's think about the simple, the believable, the sensational story that is the gospel of Jesus Christ. And let's ask ourselves, are we all in? Would the elders like to come up now and serve?